Well, there's a lot of lessons you can learn from the nation of Israel, and that this, whether we're far to the convention or near the convention, we all want to be nearer to God. And as that hymn expresses it, that's something that's so important. And unfortunately, it's a lesson. When we look at Israel, they weren't always near to God. I don't know why I'm so nervous. I've been doing this for 40 years and I still get nervous. Maybe because this lesson's not a Passover lesson. I hope you won't be disappointed. I think of Israel and their wilderness wanderings, and it didn't end after the 40 years because they did a lot of wandering after that. And they might say, we've been wandering through this wilderness for oh so many years, and our past been paved with sorrow, and our ways been washed with tears. But the Lord has always led us by His might and with His hand, and soon the Lord will lead us into the promised land. But the path that we have taken is a different one indeed than the one that God intended on that night that we were freed. But He let us have our willful way in hopes that we might see that it's better far to follow Him throughout eternity. God took Moses to the mountaintop to see the land below, and we crossed the River Jordan, defeated Jericho. But the lesson of that victory rang out both loud and clear. If we'd listened 40 years ago, we'd already be here. Well, this doesn't cover the 40 years. It covers some of those wanderings after that. And it's not specifically about that lesson. It's more a lesson in the book of Amos. And that's what we want to share with you. And we're going to be looking at a verse that you may have considered in your studies. It's a verse that is not commented on in the harvest message. But if we look at the book of Amos as a whole, it is surrounded by prophetic pictures that are known to us. And so turn to the book of Amos. You'll probably want to put some fingers in there. But especially we're going to start with chapter 5 and verse 19. In that day you will be like a man who runs from a lion only to meet a bear. Escaping from the bear, he leans his hand against the wall in his house, and he's bitten by a snake. Now, I've always wondered about that verse, and I still do. And after this discourse, you may still wonder about it too. And if you have any suggestions, please let me know. So we're going to share some thoughts with you. We're trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together from the surrounding context and see if we can fit it into what this verse might mean. Now, perhaps the most important symbol in this verse 19 is the fleeing man. The fleeing man. It says, you will be like a man who does this, that, and the other thing. Well, chapter 5 is a part of a large judgment message against the 10-tribe kingdom. In the context, it's speaking of two classes. It's speaking of the poor and needy who were being oppressed at that time. And then it also speaks of the advantaged or the richer class of the 10-tribe kingdom. And they were building stone houses. And that was a symbol of their wealth and prosperity. But we're told in verse 9 that the poorer class that was being spoiled would eventually rise up against those stone houses. The previous verse, verse 18, from Young's literal translation reads, ho, ye who are desiring the day of judgment, why is this to you the day of Jehovah? It is darkness and not light. Whoever this class is, it's the same class in verse 19, they are desiring the day of the Lord, the day of Jehovah. But it's not what they expect. And God's telling them, it's not going to be what you expect. So this must be a class that's expecting the day of Jehovah maybe to be something positive. Hard to say. But they are then forced to flee from place to place in order to seek protection. But instead, they are not protected. They are met with life-threatening danger. What we suggest is that this is a description of Christian society in general. That's the you, that's the fleeing man. They're represented by the fleeing man symbolically. This interpretation seems to fit in a number of ways, and a careful examine of examination of the book of Amos is going to tell us if that's justified or not. And you can draw your own conclusions at the end. We have a simple sequence of events concerning this man in this verse. First of all, he flees from a lion. Secondly, a bear meets him. Third, he flees from the bear and enters into a house. Fourthly, he leans his hand on the wall. And finally, a snake bites him. We find a somewhat similar sequence in Isaiah 24, verses 18 to 23. Isaiah 24, 18 to 23, which we won't read. Now, we want to look at a literal overview of the book of Amos, first of all, because this is something that really happened. And the Lord usually gives these real events in order for us to understand what the symbolic meaning might be. Now, historically, most commentators will tell you that Amos was between Elijah and Isaiah, but he was well before Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. So that puts us well before the 70 years captivity, which was a final punishment that came upon them. And so it was at a time of earthly prosperity for the rich, as already alluded to, but a time also of injustice towards and oppression of the poor. And the vast bulk of this book is a judgment message. It has a brief judgment message against all the nations surrounding Israel, and we find this in chapter 1, verse 3, through chapter 2, verse 3. So that's general judgment of the nations around Israel, chapter 1, verse 3, versus chapter 2, verse 3. There is also a very brief judgment message targeted towards the two-tribe kingdom of Judah. At this time, you know, there's the 10-tribe kingdom, and then there's the 2-tribe kingdom. The 2-tribe kingdom was Judah and Benjamin. The 10 tribes were the remainder. So a judgment message against the 2-tribe kingdom is only two verses, Amos 2, verses 4 and 5. From that point forward, chapter 2, verse 6, until chapter 9, verse 9 in particular, is a judgment message, a detailed judgment message against the 10-tribe kingdom of Israel. So the burden of this judgment is against them. When we get to Amos 9, verse 10, it's kind of summarized with a common judgment message which encompasses all the sinners of my people. But we also have a promise of regathering and restoration in chapter 9. In chapter 9, verse 8, and also 11 through 15, there is a promise of regathering and restoration. But very importantly here and interesting is the fact that it's not a promise to Judah. It is not a promise to Israel. It's a promise to Jacob. And that seems significant because we know many places Jacob represents natural Israel. So we change from a literal judgment message against two tribes and the 10 tribes and the people around, and it switches to a symbolic message concerning regathering restoration to Jacob. Concerning this period of time in reprint 5243, reprint 5243, Brother Russell says, society was on the edge of a great volcano, and God declared that an eruption was near at hand. Amos was his mouthpiece. Should remind us of our day. Let's look at a brief prophetic overview next. We see this expression in that day many times in Old Testament prophecies, and we believe that in this case, not only is it the day of the Lord, but it's also particularly the time of trouble in the day of the Lord. Then we look at animals. Animals often symbolize governments, and it's an apt symbol because animals that are used as these symbols are strong. They're able to defend themselves. We see this in Daniel chapter 7, also Revelation chapter 13 and other places. But Proverbs 28:15 is particularly appropriate. As a roaring lion and a raging bear, so is a wicked ruler over the poor people. So here you have even the sequence. Lion, bear, and it's a ruler, a government. There is a possible parallel prophecy given in 1 Samuel 17. We don't often think of this as a prophecy, 1 Samuel 17, you know, that is the incident of David slaying, well, it's before he slays Goliath. It's when he slew a lion and a bear, and he's telling Saul about this. He's telling about the slaying of a lion and a bear. Well, here we have a lion and a bear again. Maybe it's accidental, coincidental, maybe not. Brother Russell suggests in reprint 3142, and reprint 4216, 4216, that this could have been typical. And here's what he says in verse 37, 1 Samuel 17, 37. The Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. Now, if we say that in this case, perhaps David would represent our returned Lord, and that Goliath would represent the powers that be at the end of the time of trouble, then we could perhaps fit some things into that prophetic picture. Because we know that the old order will be utterly defeated by our returned Lord. But here you have, again, a sequence. You have lion, bear, and then this Philistine would kind of be the end picture of that. Now, when Jesus returned, who was in charge? Well, the kings were in control, weren't they? The divine right of kings. So the lion here, we often think of the lion as the king of the jungle. That expression is used very often. That lion could represent the kings. What took the place of the kings in World War I? Well, that was the social revolution, wasn't it? So socialism took the place of that. And some brethren have used a bear to symbolize socialism. So we remain with the house, the wall, the serpent, and what they represent. We have to ask ourselves, where is society today? What is our part in this picture? And these are questions that we hope to suggest answers for in the course of this study. So that's a brief prophetic overview. Now we want to consider the judgment feature of this prophecy. And you may recall that Brother Russell says, well, there was a literal Babylon, there was a literal judgment, literal things happened to them. But the manner in which this is expressed in the prophetic books concerning Babylon is so extravagant that it can't possibly apply to literal Babylon. It has to be symbolic. And we believe that the same concept applies here, that the judgment feature of Amos had a literal fulfillment upon Judah and Israel, but the symbolisms, the scope and the degree of the punishment and the destruction that's mentioned here would necessitate a much broader symbolic application. And it's this broader application that we hope to consider in greater detail. Okay, let's get into a symbolic overview of the book of Amos. If we go back to Amos chapter 1 and verse 2, it tells us that this was given 2 years before the earthquake. 2 years before the earthquake. Now, that may or may not be symbolic. I don't know. If it is, where would it fit? Well, it would have to be after the Lord's presence, because we already identified that in that day is referring to the time of trouble at the beginning of our Lord's parousia. But this is a judgment message before that began to take place. So it would seem to be before 1914. So between 1874 and 1914, you can do with that what you want. If it's a literal 2 years, it would be 1912. There was a lot going on at that time. There was some strong judgment messages of truth coming from the Amos class, if indeed we are the Amos class. And the photodrama was one of those. And you've probably heard the story that as the photodrama progressed across Europe, World War I was not far behind. The literal circumstances given here aptly picture the beginning of the Laodicean period. Mystical Babylon says she is rich and increased in goods. Revelation 3:17. And also in the book of Amos, chapter 6, verse 1, Amos 6:1, it says that many were at ease in Zion. And we're reminded of Ezekiel 16:49. The rich were condemned because they failed to help the poor and the needy. And these are maladies which afflict Babylon at the time of the beginning of our Lord's presence. Now, as mentioned earlier, there is a common judgment message against all the nations surrounding Israel, and we believe that that represents the fact that all the nations are to be punished in the time of trouble. It all has to go down. This old order has got to be destroyed. But there is a special fulfillment, isn't there? There's a special judgment message during this time, and that judgment message is fulfilled upon Christendom, nominal spiritual Israel. We also believe, know, that the spoiled, during this time in which we're living, the lower classes, the ones who are being pressed down by that millstone, of the lower part of the millstone, they're going to rise up against the strong. And what will the result be? The result of that is going to be anarchy. And this is alluded to in Amos chapter 5, verse 9. Now, we are also told in this prophecy that the Lord's people will not be left in darkness. And you can look at volume 2, page 22, B22. And that's from Amos 3, verses 6 and 7. Amos 3, 6 and 7. We have an obligation as the antitypical Amos. If indeed the message that Amos gave here is a message that we are also responsible to give. And there may be a possible parallel to Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, although that applies before 1914 in particular, the Elijah message. You remember, I will send Elijah the prophet for the great and dreadful day of the Lord to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, hearts of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. And we believe that that curse began in 1914, the time of trouble. But we still have an obligation after that to be giving a message. Okay, so we've made a general application that the judgment is not just upon all the nations, but it's particularly upon Christendom. Well, we have the two-tribe kingdom, and we have the ten-tribe kingdom. And if that's Christendom, then that would suggest that Christendom's divided into two parts. And, well, we kind of see that, don't we? We've already concluded that it's against Christendom, and the 12 tribes together would represent Christendom as a whole. The two parts would then logically represent Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, papacy, the Catholic part of Christendom, and then the Protestant part. The majority of Amos, the book of Amos, is a judgment against the ten-tribe kingdom, which would represent papacy, Babylon the Great. And we will see in this prophecy that Babylon's destruction, in those prophecies concerning Babylon, is complete and everlasting, and that the same thing is suggested here regarding the ten-tribe kingdom, that their destruction would be complete and everlasting. So if the two-tribe kingdom represents Protestantism, we see that they are not as responsible as papacy, but they are still responsible, and they also will be destroyed. The effects of the Reformation have largely been lost, and the protest is gone from Protestantism. As mentioned before, there is this promise of a regathering and a restoration that's mentioned in chapter 9, especially in verses 11 to 15. In the context, we would see that the regathering begins during the time of trouble, if we understand this correctly, and that certainly fits what we see with our eyes. The ultimate fulfillment, the complete restoration and regathering, would be after the time of trouble is over. And we would apply that to, say, after Jacob's trouble. James quotes this prophecy, as you remember, in Acts 15. Acts 15, verses 13 to 17. And so we believe that the time setting is appropriate, that it fits with the second advent of our Lord, and that there is an application to the rebuilding of the tabernacle of David. And we already know that Jacob often represents natural Israel. Well, what about the switch in the narrative? We already called attention to the fact that he goes along with literal, and then all of a sudden we have Jacob thrown in there. It seems appropriate. It seems necessary that there's this distinction between Jacob and the others. So we have three principal groups. Papacy shown by the ten-tribe kingdom. their punishment is the most severe, it's final, and it's everlasting. And we see this, for example, in Amos 8:2. And this could not apply to natural Israel in any antitype or fulfillment of the prophecy. Because there it says, I will spare them no longer. I will forgive them no longer. Depends which translation you look at. So this conveys the thought, and it's carried out also in Amos 8:9, the thought of utter destruction in that day. So Babylon is to have an utter destruction. And we know that the 10-tribe kingdom, though they were not destroyed militarily, they were disbanded throughout the earth. They no longer exist. Protestantism, if it's shown by the 2-tribe kingdom, they're also punished, as was mentioned in Amos 2:5. A fire shall devour their palaces. And that would represent multiple systems. So it fits with the idea of Protestantism. So, as mentioned, natural Israel is shown by Jacob in other places in the Bible. Chapter 9, verses 1 to 10, refers to the utter destruction of the sinful kingdom. And that's the 10-tribe kingdom and the 2-tribe kingdom. Well, what's left? If you destroy all 12 tribes, how are you going to show natural Israel being restored? And that's why we believe that the picture changes to Jacob. Verse 8 makes Jacob the one exception concerning this destruction which is to take place against the sinful kingdom. Now, they're not without punishment in the book of Amos, and we know that natural Israel is not without punishment. They have to go through difficulties too. But chapter 9, verses 11 through 15, 9, 11 to 15, seems to show the process of their restoration, the restoration of natural Israel during the time of trouble. Now, someone would say, okay, how do you harmonize that with Amos 3:2? Amos 3:2, we often apply to natural Israel. Well, it was a valid literal application for that time. It was a valid literal application for that time because the 10-tribe kingdom existed at that time, didn't exist after that time, so it cannot be referring to the restoration of natural Israel. Let's now proceed to examine the symbols in our theme text, Amos 5:9. As previously stated, animals often represent governments, and the suggestion is that that's what they represent here, or forms of government. If the one fleeing represents Christian society, it could show that the masses are not appeased by these different forms of government. In fact, it is these very forms of government which chase this man to his next destination. The end result is the destruction of the fleeing man, and it's unclear as to what that would represent. What class in Christian society is destroyed? Well, we know the tares are destroyed, not as people, but as tares. Perhaps that's what could be shown here, the burning of the tares. We know that the powers of Christendom have corrupted every form of government that they've ever had anything to do with and for selfish purposes. So let's look first at the lion. We know it's not Satan here. We know it's not the lion of the tribe of Judah. It has to be a government. And it fits the concept of power within that specified time period, after the Lord's return, but before the time of trouble, between 1874 and 1914. And we know that the government that was in control at that time, it was the kings. We're reminded of Isaiah 21:8. There's a man standing on the watchtower. And what does he cry? He cries, a lion. Well, some translations have that differently, but I like that one. Daniel 2:44 identifies this time period as in the days of these kings. So it fits that the lion represents the form of government that was there under the doctrine of the divine right of the kings, which ended in World War I, completely, totally, never to be restored in the future. Anything which arises in the future, which we'll talk about briefly later, would not be the divine right of kings. The bear, as already stated, after the demise of the divine right of kings, socialism was quickly embraced by world leaders, even in the United States. Roosevelt adopted the socialist platform. That's a matter of history. And it ain't over. We often look at the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989 as the fall of communism. Well, it was significant, and it was the fall of communism in that part of the world. But socialism's not dead. It was a beginning, it was an important beginning, but I personally don't think we're through with that phase just yet. The Lord knows. We know in Elijah's vision, remember Elijah's vision in 1 Kings 19, 11 and 12, 1 Kings 19, 11 and 12, what did he see? He saw the stages of the time of trouble. He saw the wind, he saw the earthquake, and he saw the fire. We know that's war, revolution, and then anarchy is the end result. Now, those are stages of the time of trouble. It's not talking about governments there. Here in this prophecy, we have a picture of governments which cover roughly the same period of time, but presented under the form of these animals. And notice that if we look at the time frame, there is an important feature that exists between the social revolution and the anarchy, between the bear and the serpent. I hope you're following that. Okay? You got wind, earthquake, fire. War, revolution, anarchy. Revolution, anarchy. You have lion, bear. At the end, you have serpent. Well, we've got this other aspect in between those. So, what is that? That's the house, the wall, the hand. Well, the house is not an animal, obviously. But if we look at the context, it's still a form of government. Well, the fact that it's not an animal is significant. It's the fact that it's a government is suggested by the context. But this house is unique. And why isn't it symbolized by an animal? Because this house is supposedly a place of protection, as already mentioned. The man views the house differently than the lion and the bear. He wants to run away from the lion and the bear. The house seems to offer protection from danger. Some brethren in the past, in looking at this verse, they suggested that perhaps the house might represent nationalism. Well, that's a possibility. You can decide for yourself. And to tell you the truth, when I started out this study, I had this in my mind. Well, okay, this is what I've heard. But in discussing this with other brethren, and I thank them for their input on this, there's another unique form of government that's portrayed in Revelation. In Revelation chapter 16, 13, we have the alliance there of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. In Revelation 17, we also have an alliance that's shown. Well, maybe these prophecies fit somehow into the Amos picture. We know that this house does not offer any genuine rest or safety to the fleeing man. And so whatever form of government this is, it is not going to give rest and safety to the masses of Christendom, even though that's what they hoped for. On the surface, it appears to be a protective arrangement. But we know from looking at these other prophecies in Revelation 16 and 17 that they are actually oppressive. The efforts of the governments will be to confine and to control the masses. And so the house, rather than being a refuge, becomes almost a prison. The wall provides no support. It provides no rest to the masses. They put their hand there. Well, we know in other places in prophecy that the hand represents activity. Well, in this picture, that activity is brought to an end. And how is it brought to an end? It's brought to an end by the serpent. Something happens to bring an end to Christian society. And as suggested, perhaps this is showing the burning of the tares. Okay, the serpent. Well, we made a point. The lion is an animal, it's a government. The bear is an animal, it's a government. The house is a government, it's not an animal. Now we come to an animal that's not a government. The serpent, it's an animal, but it's not a form of government. It's actually the lack of government. And it's destructive. It's a cold-blooded and venomous animal, and it shows the destruction and the absence of government. It represents anarchy. Now, you remember in Volume 4, especially page 481, D481, Brother Russell talks about anarchy as a proposed remedy. Proposed remedy, but it's not a form of government. And this is an unexpected result on the part of the fleeing man. He's looking for safety. He's looking for some form of government that will act in his best interest. And he finds out to the contrary. None of them served him. Rather, they, in this case, destroy him. Thence I will command the serpent, and he shall bite them. Amos 9:3. Now, in Amos 9, verse 12, it speaks of the masses as the nations that are called by my name. And there again, it fits with the idea of Christendom, the Christian society. And in Amos 9:13, a familiar passage, Amos 9:13, the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that soweth seed. At some point, the work of the harvest comes to an end, is overtaken by the plowman of the time of trouble. The final phase of the time of trouble is anarchy. The final battle with the serpent is not shown in this prophecy, but this is where we will enter the picture. That's not particularly shown in Amos. It's shown in other places. Romans 16:20. And the God of peace shall bruise Satan under your feet shortly. Genesis 3:15 has been mentioned several times. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Genesis 3:15. So the book of Amos, the purpose of this prophecy, is not to show the destruction of the various forms of government. Doesn't focus on that. It's to show the transition to these successive forms of government. We don't see the lion being killed. We just see the man fleeing from the lion. We don't see the bear being killed. We just see the man fleeing from the bear. We do not see the snake being killed. We just see it biting the fleeing man. What is shown here is the consequences of these various forms of government. But it does not show the destruction of the governments themselves. That we find in other prophecies. So, what destruction is shown here? The bulk of the prophecy, as already stated several times, is the judgment message against nominal Christendom. It's a judgment that's not merely against the religious institutions themselves. It's also against the rich in Christendom, against the leaders in Christendom, and of course we use Christendom so-called, that's what they call themselves. It shows the eventual destruction of their riches and of their authority. And it also perhaps shows the destruction of the tares as tares. Now there are other places in prophecy where beasts are shown, and also the destruction of those beasts. But again, the purpose here is to show the transition from one to the other. Well, why is that important to us? Why should we care? Because there are important lessons there. As already suggested at the beginning, a very broad overall lesson is to look at the nation of Israel and see what they did and to try not to do the same things, to try not to make those same mistakes. But also, if our understanding of this prophecy is correct, it's one of several places that help us to know where we are on the stream of time. It is also one of several places where we see the fulfillment of prophecy in the past. Our past, but it was Brother Russell's future. He saw it ahead of time. He told it to us when all he had was just a little inkling of its beginnings, or in some cases, nothing at all. But he saw from the Word of God, this is how it's going to happen, and in this sequence. And we've watched it unfold. And that confirms to us, that convinces us that the Word of God is true, correct, and sure. Most of the detailed prophecies that we've alluded to here have already been fulfilled or begun fulfillment. And so those parts which are yet future are just as sure of fulfillment. So that should give us faith. But also, the principles that are enumerated here confirm to us that God's judgments are sure. We already see much of this in the past. We await the climax in the future. But we must also and always remember the purpose and the scope of that judgment work. It's the destruction of the false systems. Remember in the fourth volume forward, Brother Russell says, we speak about systems always, individuals never. And that's important for us, especially in how we view current events. The false systems will be destroyed. The terror class will be burned, not as individuals, but as a class. And their ashes will return to the ground, to the earth, where they belong. Because they're really part of the earth, not part of God's people. But we know that the people remain. You know that very famous two verses in Zephaniah chapter 3, 8 and 9. Zephaniah 3, 8 and 9. Concerning the fire of God's jealousy, which is going to burn up the earth in that day. But afterwards, he turns to the people, a pure language. And we wait for that time. The book of Amos gives us some very important practical advice. If we are the Amos class, which I believe we are, we don't want to be like the fleeing man. We don't want to be like those in positions of power either. We don't put our trust in earthly governments. As was brought out, well, we respect the laws where they don't conflict with the laws of God. But our trust is not in earthly governments because we are aliens and strangers. Our citizenship is in heaven. So what about politics? Let's stay out of it. Let's try to remain neutral. I know that's hard. It's hard for me, too. I see stuff and, oh, I just want to say something. Well, if we do say something, let's make sure we're talking about the systems and the principles and actions and stay away from either bashing or uplifting people. And we want to stay out of high finance. Well, Brother Russell, he made those suggestions in many places. Where's our treasure? Our treasure is to be up in heaven. So we need to be careful in the time which we're living. The time of trouble is pretty far along based on what we've seen here, both with Elijah's vision, you know, the flames of anarchy. We see them poking up their heads all over the place. I don't believe it's full blown yet, but we're close. And in this prophetic picture, it also shows that we're close. So what do? We need to be prepared. We need to be prepared to leave. That's ultimately what it's all about, right? And that fits in with our memorial meditations in a very general way. Here we have no continuing city. Try to live within your means. Try to live below your means. Downsize, downsize, downsize. You don't own your stuff. Your stuff owns you. And you know that. And you know, we talk about labor-saving devices. Well, they may be labor-saving, but you notice they don't call them time-saving. And I believe that's also significant. So we need to remember who we are, what we are, why we're here, where we're going. And we need to recognize God's judgments against these systems, against Babylon the Great, against her daughters, against the political systems of this world. And to have no part in that, to have no part in those systems, to have no part of the fleeing man class. And we have to be careful. Why? Because you might say, well, you said don't be politically involved and all that. That's true. But you know, it still is very easy for us to be overcharged with the cares of this life in one way or another. And the Lord is warning us not to do that. We need to be focused. We need to help each other to be focused, to keep our attention on what the Lord wants us to be focused on. There are many dangerous beasts out there today, all kinds. But the greatest one of all is the one that's behind them all. And that's the adversary. And in due time, he will be dealt with. Satan, the dragon, the serpent, the devil. So Romans 16:20 is important to us, but especially if we remain faithful and we are part of those who will fulfill that prophecy in Romans 16:20, the God of peace shall bruise Satan under your feet shortly. Dear brethren, may we be found faithful to work together with our returned Lord in the destruction of all these dangerous beasts and in the full establishment of that kingdom for which we have prayed for so long. When the lion shall lie down with the lamb, and none shall make afraid. Isaiah 11:6, Isaiah 65:25, and Micah 4:4. Well, brethren, we're not going to ask for questions. We're going to give you extra time today for your fellowship and for your meal. I know many of you are leaving, will be leaving. We probably won't have a chance to get around and say goodbye to all of you. So let this count as that, and may the Lord be with you and keep you till we meet again. May the Lord add his blessing.